Chapter 7, ADHD in the Family. I had an epiphany a few years before my diagnosis. As I walked into our basement and saw my half-finished project spread out in disarray on the workbench, something I started long before but lost interest in, I thought for the first time, this is something Bruce would do. We did not realize that Bruce, our middle son, had inattentive ADHD when he was in grade school, but we knew from his behavior that he would likely flounder in a large middle school. We sent him to a private school, where he was in a class of just 12 students. I don't remember what made me begin to connect inattentive ADHD with Bruce's challenges. Perhaps I first learned about the disorder at a presentation that started me thinking he might have it. I read the literature and shared what I read with Steve, but the descriptions sometimes sounded like Bruce and other times not. They typically described the more common form of ADHD that included hyperactivity in addition to inattention and impulsivity. Bruce was not hyperactive. Looking over the scattered traces of my forgotten project, I wondered if Steve had nagged me to pick it up and put it away, as I nagged Bruce when he left things unfinished or did not pick up after himself. I wondered for the first time, do I have inattentive ADHD like my son? After that, I read more about inattentive ADHD, but this time with myself rather than Bruce in mind. However, I found no literature about inattentive ADHD in adults. It was more confusing than helpful to read descriptions of inattentive ADHD in children. Certain behaviors fit me, while others did not. I let any concern about having inattentive ADHD fade from my mind until that day in 1992 when my supervisor at work evaluated me in my office. In two previous part-time jobs, working as a hospital discharge planner and as a social worker on the staff of a multidisciplinary team assessing elderly patients, my supervisors had vague complaints about the lack of thoroughness in my work. They did not recognize that my challenges resulted from my undiagnosed and untreated disorder. My younger brother, Asa, was diagnosed with ADHD as an adult, probably in the early 1980s when he was in his 30s. He took the bar examination to become an attorney several times before passing. Maybe that was his impetus for being diagnosed. I had not seen him since 1969 when I moved to Seattle and did not know which of his behaviors got him diagnosed. As a child, I knew my mother regularly took Asa to see a psychiatrist in Worcester, Massachusetts, 45 minutes away. At the time, the primary tool psychiatrist had for helping people was talk therapy. My brother told me he played card games with the psychiatrist. I never knew why he saw a psychiatrist, and he was not prescribed any medication. I don't remember any of my brother's behaviors that would have made me think two of my sons had the same issues. My only significant problem with my younger brother during my childhood was calling the neighbors and asking them to send Asa home because it was time for supper. He never came home without my phone call. Today, we understand that ADHD is highly inheritable, but we did not know that in the 1980s, let alone in the 1950s. If one or two parents have ADHD, the likelihood that one or more children have it increases. A physician told me that second to a person's height, ADHD is the most inherited condition. Yet I had no reason to think my sons had ADHD just because my brother was diagnosed with this disorder. It was not until the 1990s when interest in ADHD swelled and there was increased research into the causes that we began to develop a better understanding of how this disorder presents. Research by Stephen Ferrone, PhD, shows that about 25% of children diagnosed with ADHD have a parent with the same disorder. And Ted Mandelkorn, MD, a pediatrician who exclusively diagnoses and treats children with ADHD, says 90% of those with ADHD have a relative in the immediate or extended family with the disorder. Dr. Orrin Mason once told me he had diagnosed ADHD in 5 generations of the same family. Yet adults were and still are rarely diagnosed with ADHD. In the 1990s, when I was diagnosed, researchers believed less than 20% of adults with ADHD were diagnosed. Although that percentage has increased with time, it is still too low. Population studies show that many adults with ADHD have never been diagnosed. There are numerous reasons for this. Many adults are unaware they have ADHD, even when everyday tasks are burdensome. They may deny their difficulties even when a friend points them out. Some adults were diagnosed as children and wrongly believe they outgrew it, or when they seek professional help, they are incorrectly diagnosed. According to Dr. William Dodson, an ADHD expert, clinicians frequently misdiagnose adults with ADHD as having a mood disorder. On average, adults see 2.3 clinicians and complete 6.6 antidepressant trials before they are diagnosed correctly with attention deficit disorder. Another reason adults are underdiagnosed is that many people and clinicians have a limited view of ADHD. They typically associate it with hyperactivity and poor focus. Adults often present without hyperactivity. If they were hyperactive as children, they learned to moderate their hyperactivity and express it in socially acceptable ways. They might doodle, jingle change in their pocket, wiggle a foot, tap a finger, or walk about. Adults with ADHD can have excellent focus and often can hyperfocus. The degree of our focus depends on our interest in the task. Sometimes parents refuse to accept a diagnosis of ADHD for their child, exclaiming, "How can you say he is inattentive when he spends hours playing video games?" When we hyperfocus, we lose track of time. When working on this memoir, I sat at a computer in my home office, unaware of my surroundings. I was only aware of the writing on the computer screen. When I glanced away from the computer, I was surprised that it was dark outside and time to start dinner. Where did the hours go? After reading a draft of this memoir, my sister Melissa suggested I include input from people who knew me before my diagnosis and treatment. What did they notice about me? Did they notice I was different from most adults? So I asked her, "Did you notice anything unusual about me growing up or when we took bike trips together?" Her only response was, "I remember on one bike trip, you told me how much Ritalin was helping you, and then you told me you left it behind at the last motel." When I asked my oldest son, he said, "I wasn't aware of you being unusual." When I asked my husband, he said, "I knew you lacked caution and engaged in risky behaviors. You were thrill-seeking, and sometimes you went too far. I knew this about you when we married, but I just thought that was how you were." He continued, "Remember when you went ziplining in Costa Rica? You were 67 years old and had no idea what you were getting into. I tried, without success, to prevent you from going. When you finished the course of 10 different ziplines, you told me how frightened you were, but that it was impossible to turn back once you started the course. On one zipline, you had to be rescued because you grasped the line too tightly. This made you stop in the middle, where you dangled and twisted from side to side above the deepest canyon on the course. I tried to put checks on your risk-taking. Sometimes things worked out for you, but other times you overestimated your abilities. Unless our behaviors are way off the charts, it's unlikely anyone will think brain disorder when they encounter an adult with atypical behaviors. They will just label us unusual, irritating, reckless, or moody, or another disparaging term. Our inability to recognize mild and moderate brain disorders contributes to the small number of adults diagnosed with ADHD. Although females are believed to have ADHD as often as males, the public image of ADHD is overwhelmingly of the hyperactive boy. For this reason, girls, who more commonly have the inattentive type of ADHD, are diagnosed much less frequently than hyperactive boys are, by a ratio of 1 to 3. It is theorized that those with the inattentive type of ADHD, which includes some boys, are underdiagnosed because they are daydreaming in class, not acting out and being disruptive. Current knowledge about ADHD is that the disorder has three different presentations: predominantly hyperactive impulsive, about 10% of cases, predominantly inattentive, 30% of cases, and combined presentation, about 60% of cases. During a person's life, the predominant presentation can vary. Undiagnosed ADHD in any presentation is damaging and needs an early diagnosis and treatment. It was 2 additional years after we first thought that inattentive ADHD might explain Bruce's difficulties before we took him for an evaluation. We had different but still troublesome behaviors from our youngest son, Jackson, but because he did well in school, it did not occur to us until 2 years after Bruce's diagnosis that he might have ADHD as well. Bruce's challenges involved not doing the things he should, while Jackson did things he should not. I am sure that denial contributed to our delay in seeking help. No parent wants to believe there is something wrong with their children, something more concerning than typical, although annoying, behavior that warrants outside interventions and possibly medication. Until we accepted that our son's problem behaviors were beyond our ability to rectify, I thought they were simply misbehaving, and if I disciplined them better, they would behave better. ADHD is a disorder and a demoralizing label. My brother Asa had significant problems in life because of ADHD. He had trouble finishing high school and took years to graduate from a 3-year business course at Babson College. He went on to study law, but had trouble advancing in his career. Often, treatment for ADHD does not eliminate all the symptoms of the disorder. I never asked Asa if he continued to take medication when he worked as an attorney. Once they function better, it is not unusual for people mistakenly to believe, "I no longer need medication." When they stop taking it, their problem behaviors return and they are unaware of the change. A friend called me about her son who graduated from college. He was hired for a wonderful job, but was fired within a year. In talking with her, I learned that he stopped taking his ADHD medication when he graduated. He thought he only needed it to perform well in his studies, not appreciating medication's wide-ranging effects on all aspects of a person's performance. After he saw a psychiatrist in California who prescribed the needed medication, another company hired him and he became a valued employee. What I knew about ADHD made me reluctant to associate my children with this disorder. Would I be consigning them to a bleak future? Wasn't it a handicapping condition? Once diagnosed, that was it. Instead of focusing on how treatment brings improvement, I chose to deny the possibility that Bruce and Jackson had a disorder. It was more hopeful to believe that better parenting skills would make a difference than to think there was something that needed fixing. Our oldest son, Charles, was no trouble. He was the model child. Why did the parenting methods I used to raise him not have the same result with my other sons? When we presented this conundrum to our family therapist, he said, "You aren't parenting your other sons the right way for them." But what was the right way? ADHD runs in families. Siblings of youth with ADHD and children of adults with ADHD are at high risk for ADHD and should be screened. About 25% of parents who have children with ADHD may require treatment for ADHD and/or co-occurring disorders.